Support for this podcast comes from Compass Real Estate, where your home is our mission. Pairing the Bay Area's top agents with technology to make the home buying and selling experience smart and seamless. Search homes at compass.com or download the Compass mobile app.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. This week, the CDC released a study showing that tick-borne illnesses have tripled in the United States between 2004 and 2016. Those illnesses include West Nile virus, dengue, and Zika, but it was Lyme disease that contributed to more than 80% of reported cases. And despite what many may think, Lyme disease is a threat not just in the Midwest or the Northeast parts of the country. It's showing up in our own backyard. We'll discuss the rise of Lyme disease in Northern California, what's causing it, and how to stay safe. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. From 2004 to 2016, reported cases of diseases spread by fleas, mosquitoes, and tick bites tripled in the United States, and that's according to a new study by the Centers for Disease Control. The surge in illnesses includes cases of West Nile virus and Zika, but it was Lyme disease that accounted for 80% of reported tick-borne incidents. And we're going to examine what's causing the rise of insect-borne diseases in this forum hour and how Lyme disease in particular is affecting Northern California. Let me tell you who is joining us for the program. We want to welcome Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's the author of Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change, and she joins us this morning from Woodstock, New York. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Good to have you with us. We also have Raphael Stricker with us. He's a physician, internal medicine physician, and former president of the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. He joins us from his home in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Dr. Stricker.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you, and also a pleasure to have Andrea Sway here with us in studio. She's assistant professor of biology at San Francisco State University, and welcome, Professor Stay.
Thanks.
Let me begin, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, if I may, with you. And the reason I'm beginning with you is because you've done a lot of first-rate investigative reporting, and the CDC report doesn't necessarily mention the fact that ticks are born to warm climates and we have climate change, but there's nothing in the report about climate change.
Well, unfortunately, the issue of climate change is colored by our political landscape, I fear. And that is probably one reason it wasn't mentioned. I will say that the author of the report did make several public statements in which he said warming is occurring, and that is allowing ticks to survive in many new places. And that's basically what I found in my research of the scientific literature. I compared archival data to current situations of in terms of where ticks can live. And it's pretty clear that it is a great time to be a tick on planet Earth right now. Ticks are moving north, not only through the U.S., but into Canada, which is a new frontier for Lyme disease. They're moving north into Scandinavia, Russia, China, even Australia. Many, many countries around the globe are having a problem with tick-borne disease.
And that means more and more, unfortunately, Lyme disease and the other associated illnesses. But let me ask you just in general, I mean, it may be a scandal in many people's minds. I think it is that there was nothing in the report about climate change. But there's another scandal here, and that's a scandal that you've written about in your book. And I'd like you to just outline this for our listeners. You're talking about the way Lyme disease in the United States is managed. You've called it a scandal. You call it a moral and legal disgrace.
I do indeed, Michael. For years, this disease has been framed as something that is relatively easy to diagnose and pretty straightforward to cure and to treat. And neither of those premises is correct. We have a test for Lyme disease that is very difficult to use. It fails many patients at various stages of the disease, especially early on. More than 50% of people will incorrectly test. They will not test positive when, in fact, they are. And the test gets better as the disease progresses. But it isn't until you're in the, you know, what they call the late disseminated stage Namely, those spirochetes, as they're called, have moved throughout your body, that you get the best results with that test. So for a long time, we've known it's a very poor diagnostic tool. The other thing is we have long been told that 10 to 28 days of antibiotics will kill the infection in the human body. Tops, you may need a second course. We're finding there's lots of emerging scientific studies that are basically coming to the conclusion that the way we treat Lyme disease may not be working, that the frontline antibiotics, doxycycline in particular, doesn't, in fact, kill the infection, which explains why, and the CDC does acknowledge this, 10 to 20% of people will continue to be sick even after treatment. And the scandal, to get back to that word that I refer to, is that these problems are not recognized either by the Centers for Disease Control or the medical societies that really govern this disease.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer is the author of Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change, and an investigative journalist for 3 decades. And Andrea Sway is here with us in studio. She's assistant professor of biology at San Francisco State. It is a complex disease, and there are many enigmas still to this disease. I'm talking, of course, about Lyme disease, Professor. But let's talk about the fact that Lyme disease and ticks in general are now infecting so many different species of animals, and most notably, I suppose, for people here who are concerned about it, dogs, but also horses, cattle. I mean, and they're in deer. We've got the whole range of species, don't we?
Yeah, one of the reasons that it is such an important emerging disease is that the ticks are generalists, so they will feed on any number of vertebrate animals for their blood, and as a result, they are able to spread these pathogens, Lyme disease and other pathogens, between these hosts that they must feed on to complete their life cycle. And so certainly humans and domesticated animals, pets, as well as the wildlife that these pathogens are naturally maintained in, are all susceptible to acquiring and getting sick.
Just from a biological standpoint, it's kind of fascinating, though, to read about what happens, for example, with a gray squirrel as opposed to lizards that work against the disease. But let's talk about, just in general, the differences. It's often associated with the East Coast, and yet here in Northern California and throughout the West Coast, we've got a ubiquitous problem.
This is true. When I started working on Lyme disease as a grad student in California, and I think this still exists, but there are a lot of people who are really unaware that we have Lyme disease here. There are people that don't know that we have ticks here, but we do, and it's concentrated in certain habitats and in certain areas, and the seasonality is quite different. And in my work, I found that a lot of the rules and what evidence that we know about Lyme disease transmission and ecology from the East Coast really it can't be translated here directly. It's a very different ecology, and we have a very unique set of hosts that the ticks naturally feed on and interact with the ticks in really interesting and unique ways.
Lower prevalence here, but they spread differently. I mean, it's really kind of a whole different playbook for the ticks. Huh?
It really is. Recent work that I've been actually just was published earlier this month or last month was looking at the effect of human encroachment and fragmentation on the risk of disease. On the East Coast, a lot of the more disturbed, smaller habitats, pieces of land that people tend to live nearby, have really high densities of ticks and have high densities of the reservoir that the ticks can acquire the pathogen from. And so as a result, you can have really high risk in these sort of small disturbed areas. But our work here in California shows that those small disturbed areas that people tend to live near actually don't have a lot of ticks. They don't have a lot of the reservoirs that the ticks can pick up the pathogen from. Instead, the ticks are much more common in the larger tracts of land that have a lot more host diversity and have a lot more deer.
We're talking again about Lyme disease and about the rise in Northern California of Lyme disease and really all over the world. And Raphael Stricker is past president of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, the ELADS. He's also a physician in internal medicine. And Dr. Stricker, it's so hard to diagnose, as Mary Beth Pfeiffer said. Do we really know how many cases we have out there and how many cases are extant?
Well, the original numbers from the CDC reported 30,000 new cases a year. However, in 2013, the CDC revised that number to show that over 300,000 cases of Lyme disease are diagnosed each year in the U.S. So this is really a major epidemic. It's six times more common than AIDS. It's 20 times more common than tuberculosis and 30 times more common than hepatitis C virus infection in our country.
Well, I know people are listening and thinking about symptoms and prevention, and let's get right into the former first, because you read about fevers and headaches and rashes and that signature bullseye rash particularly, but a lot of these, I mean, it's called the great imitator, Lyme disease, because it imitates so many symptoms, doesn't it?
It does, and a lot of the symptoms are nonspecific. It's very hard to diagnose based on the symptoms because it mimics a lot of other diseases, just the way that syphilis used to do in the last century, and it can be very challenging, especially as Mary Beth said, the testing misses more than half of patients, and even in later disease, the testing is not that accurate.
So the toughness of diagnosing it gets down to the fact that a lot of people really don't know that they have it, and a lot of doctors don't even see it on their radar screens, do they?
They don't, and I wish I had a nickel for every time I've heard that there's no Lyme disease in California. There's plenty of Lyme disease. Northern California is endemic for Lyme disease, which means there's a lot of it around here in different parts of the northern part of the state, and people just don't know it. It's hard to get it diagnosed and treated.
And yet, if you want to get the best and optimal treatment, you have to catch it early. So since about fewer than half of the people who have been bitten can actually feel the symptoms or come to recognize the symptoms, what can you advise people? What kind of wisdom do you have?
Well, it definitely is better to diagnose it early and to be very vigilant about the disease. Awareness of the disease is very important. So when people go out hiking and camping, they should do tick checks and wear tick repellent and look for ticks on their dogs and on their kids and be very aware of the risk of the disease.
And let's talk more about prophylactic ways of avoiding these ticks and particularly avoiding the bites that lead to Lyme disease. Avoiding high grass and leaf litter and walking in the center of trails, I read, when you're hiking are really things to live by?
That's correct. You have to avoid the things that places where ticks can hide. Using tick repellents is very effective. Using things like DEET and permethrin work pretty well. Also clothing that's impregnated with tick repellents is also very good. The U.S. military has that kind of uniform clothing, and people who go hiking and camping should do the same.
Yeah, there is an EPA-approved insect repellent, and anything with permethrin really works here, particularly in terms of boots and socks and pants and the like. But showering also when you come in from a hike is a pretty good idea, isn't it?
Right, that's a good idea. Showering and also putting your clothing in the washer and drying it will get rid of the ticks most of the time, although ticks are very hardy creatures and they can survive even drying up to a certain temperature. So it's really important to keep them off you in the first place.
All right, we're talking about the CDC report and also about tick-borne diseases, particularly and more specifically Lyme disease. And we do want to hear from you. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, you can join the program, and I invite you to do that now. Let me give you the phone number, and it's a toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to bring your questions and comments forward and join the program. Again, you can do that at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and certainly I know there are many of you who are suffering from Lyme disease, and you may want to bring your own experiences and your own narratives into the discussion here in the conversation, but we certainly welcome the concerns that you have, and there are concerns here in Northern California, contrary to some of the myths that have propagated the idea otherwise. Can we also ask you, Dr. Stricker, about the problem of overdiagnosis?
Well, overdiagnosis has been a concern, certainly in the medical community, for a number of years, but I think it's very clear from the how bad the testing is and how nonspecific the symptoms are, that really underdiagnosis is a much bigger problem, especially in California, where there's little awareness among the medical community in a lot of places, and people just miss the diagnosis. So that's a much bigger problem.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Andrea Sway. Andrea Sway, again, is assistant professor of biology at San Francisco State. We're beginning to understand more about how actually disease forms, particularly in terms of these microbiomes.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. I mean, what is it exactly, and what does it tell us, especially because there's even some discussion I've been reading about it maybe being passed down in families, not necessarily genetically, but just from living in the same household and sharing the same food and so forth.
Right. So certainly we are learning a lot about the human microbiome through the Human Microbiome Project. And there's been increasing attention to looking at vectors and animal systems, too, and how microbiomes, the sort of community of microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, fungi can interact to impact health. And so from a vector-borne disease perspective, my lab has been interested in looking at how some of the native required microbes in ticks can affect pathogen transmission.
So what are you learning?
So we're learning, you know, ticks are really, I'm an ecologist. I'm really interested in the interactions between species. And ticks have these really amazing life histories where they feed on one meal a year, live for 3 years, the native species here. And as a result, they have really important endosymbionts that they have to harbor in order to complete their life cycle. And these endosymbionts might have really important impacts on pathogen transmission. There have been some cases of knowing that the endosymbionts can inhibit pathogen transmission, and in some cases they may promote pathogen transmission that are passed horizontally from their blood meal host, whereas the endosymbionts can be passed from the female to her eggs and offspring. And so looking at some of these interactions between microbes is becoming really important. And one thing we're finding is that lizards are really important in terms of hosting lots of ticks here in California. And as you suggested earlier, they have a very interesting ability to cleanse feeding ticks of any Borrelia, the Lyme disease pathogen infection. So their blood will actually kill that bacteria.
Especially true of the blue-bellied lizard?
Yeah, so the western fence lizard, otherwise known as the blue-bellied lizard, is really ubiquitous in California and is a very unique component of the Lyme disease system here.
Let me go back, if I may, to Mary Beth Pfeiffer. Mary Beth Pfeiffer, there are pretty strict federal reporting guidelines for Lyme disease, aren't there?
Yes, there are. And unfortunately, they have also served to minimize this epidemic. For example, in California, which is considered a low incidence state, you have to have a positive test for Lyme disease, even if you have a Lyme rash. In other states, in high incidence states, a Lyme rash is diagnostic in and of itself. Here, the bar is much higher. So you may present to your doctor, you may have the rash, and the doctor reads the CDC guidelines that say you have to test positive as well, and you may not be treated. The doctor should know to treat you, frankly, because that is diagnostic of Lyme disease. But this is what happens to many people. It even happens in the Northeast, where I live and where Lyme is extremely prevalent. There has been this over-concern with falsely diagnosing Lyme disease. So even in the face of blatant evidence, doctors will sometimes say, no, you don't have Lyme disease. You don't fit that strict surveillance definition. So as a result of that, in California, for example, where some of your areas are every bit as high as areas in high-incidence states, by the way, this serves to keep the numbers of people infected low. It reinforces the message to doctors, there's not much Lyme disease here, it's rare, and, it's not high on my priority list to look for it.
Let me go back, if I may, to Dr. Stricker, and we're going to get to your phone calls shortly here, as well as your emails and so forth. And again, remind you, you can join us either by phone or email, or going to our website and posting questions or comments there. There's a name I know you probably recognize, Dr. Stricker, Dr. Alan Steele, who was credited with maybe making the first diagnosis of Lyme disease up in Lyme, Connecticut. But I alluded earlier to this overdiagnosis problem, and Dr. Steele has spoken out recently about long-term antibiotic treatment as being, well, inadvisable and a bad idea.
So Dr. Steele is a rheumatologist who first described Lyme disease back in the 1970s. He has very definite opinions about the disease, but I'm afraid that the disease has kind of overtaken his beliefs by now. And we know a lot more about the disease than we did back in the 1970s. And in some cases, antibiotics are really the only way to treat this disease. And sometimes if the disease is not diagnosed early, it requires a significant amount of antibiotic treatment to get rid of this infection. And I actually wanted to go back to something that Andrea said, and that is that ticks carry something like 237 bacteria. So when you're bitten by a tick, you're not just getting one bacteria. You're getting a whole bunch of stuff, and there are a number of co-infections that go with Lyme. And Lyme has become a much more complicated disease since what Dr. Steer described back in the 1970s.
And let's bring on some callers. And Dave, we'll begin with you as our first caller. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to go back to the preventative piece about DEET. I think there's some hesitancy because of the concerns about long-term effects of DEET. And there's been some really good studies that show DEET at lower percentages are really effective. So you don't need to have 99% DEET as a repellent. The Canadian government actually did a study showing that DEET as low as 15 to 25% would be effective. And I teach wilderness medicine, and as a parent, I would much rather put DEET on appropriately for my children, which I do, than be worried about the 270 bacteria that potentially could be getting into their body. And so I just wanted to, I know there's some hesitancy with using DEET, and as your guest said, it's effective, and you don't need to be going out and buying 99% DEET.
Response about the level of DEET, Rafael Stricker?
So I can only quote the California Department of Public Health, which says that you need at least 30% DEET to repel ticks. That's what the studies show from mainly UC Berkeley. Dr. Bob Lane did some of those studies. So you do need a certain level of DEET to protect you from ticks. If you use a lower level, it doesn't seem to work.
Can you say something, Dr. Stricker, about other tick-borne diseases? I mean, mountain spotted fever, for example, comes quickly to mind in many people.
Right. So there are a number of co-infections that we're seeing with Lyme now. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is not very common in California. It's seen more in the Midwest, but there are other rickettsial diseases, which Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a member of that family. We're seeing a lot of that in California now. We're seeing a lot of it in Mexico. We're seeing patients from Mexico who have those infections. And there are other co-infections such as Babesia, Anaplasma, Ehrlichia, Bartonella. These are all possible co-infections that are transmitted by ticks along with the Lyme disease, and they make it much more difficult to treat the Lyme disease when people have these co-infections.
All right, we are coming up on a break, and as I said, when we return, we'll take more of your calls and emails. Candace writes, and let me go to you on this, if I may, quickly, Andrea Sway. Hearing about prevalence of Lyme disease is terrifying. One thing I haven't heard answered is what percentage of ticks actually carry the disease. Do we know?
We do know. We can go out and collect ticks and measure them, but it's very variable. They range from 0 to 21%, depending on the site and the year. So that's one of the challenges with studying Lyme disease, especially in California.
And if you have more questions about, well, the challenges of not only studying Lyme disease, but about the possibility of actually getting Lyme disease or what to do about ticks and how to prevent Lyme disease, this is a program for you. We welcome your calls and emails. You can join us. Forum at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
Sutter Health CPMC. CPMC has served San Francisco for more than 150 years and is proud to open its new Mission Bernal campus in August 2018. Designed as a healing environment, the new hospital has all private rooms, pediatric after-hours care, and the specialists and facilities to provide comprehensive maternity services, including low-intervention and multidimensional birth methods. Learn more and take a virtual tour at cpmc2020.org.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the Center for Disease Control report on the rise of, well, not only mosquitoes and fleas, but particularly focusing on ticks and Lyme disease, which often kind of results from tick bites. In fact, let me tell you who is with us for this hour. Mary Beth Pfeiffer is an author of a book called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. She's an investigative journalist for three decades, and Andrea Sway's here in studio. She's an assistant professor of biology at San Francisco State University, and Raphael Stricker, MD, physician, internal medicine, and past president of International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. And Dr. Stricker, is going to, before we go to more of our calls and emails, just ask you, ticks are not the only way that Lyme disease is transmitted, but we're uncertain. I kind of alluded to this earlier about how else. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so ticks are the only proven way that Lyme disease is transmitted. We know that the bacteria that cause Lyme disease are carried by mosquitoes. A recent report showed that they're also in bird mites, so that might be another method of transmission. But the problem is that it's never been proven that those insects can transmit the disease. So if you're a purist, you have to say, well, ticks are the only way they can be that the disease can be transmitted.
That's only for purists, though.
That's right, only for purists.
Let me bring some callers on here. Shireen joins us. Shireen, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call today and say thank you for having this program on. I am born and raised in the Bay Area for 40 years, never seen a tick, and this past weekend was gardening in my house in San Mateo, just light pruning, and went in it. It was pretty disgusting.
Met your first tick.
My first tick in 40 years, and then on Sunday, the very next day, went hiking in Pacifica at a county park, and my friend who was wearing light pants had a tick on their pants. So I just want to let people know this is relevant and it's validating. So thank you. And it's right in our backyard in suburbia.
Oh, thank you, Shireen. They are out there and I appreciate your call. But here's a caller from Westport, Connecticut, Abby, who thinks maybe there's a little hysteria about Lyme disease. Abby, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thank you for having this discussion. So yes, yeah, so I live in Westport, Connecticut, which, you know, it's extremely prevalent, almost guaranteed that somebody in your household is going to get Lyme disease. And in fact, my son had the bullseye and was diagnosed with Lyme disease and given antibiotics, and then he was fine. However, there's lots of people who show whether things from Meniere's disease to ALS, and doctors are telling them that it's actually Lyme disease. I have a friend whose daughter had a blood infection, and somebody told her it was Lyme, and she pulled her out of Yale Hospital and went to this woman who was putting her in a special sauna and a barium chamber, and, you know, cost her thousands of dollars. Her daughter wound up back at Yale, you know, having to get the correct drugs. And I think there are people preying on this fear.
Can I ask you to address that, Dr. Stricker, Raphael Stricker?
Well, certainly you have to be very careful when you're diagnosing Lyme disease that you're not missing some other disease that might be causing these symptoms. I have patients who come to me basically with million-dollar workups from places like Yale and, you know, the other academic institutions, and all of those workups are negative. And then when you test them for Lyme disease, they're positive for the disease or a co-infection or both. And when you put them on antibiotic treatment, they improve. So yes, you have to be very careful, not label everything as Lyme disease. But as we said earlier in the program, Lyme disease is the great imitator, and it can imitate a lot of other diseases. But you really have to be very careful in your diagnosis.
But when you have symptoms like fatigue, chronic pain, those kinds of things, it's really kind of hard to get at what may be the cause of it as far as Lyme disease, isn't it?
Well, it is. You have to do testing in a lab that's competent to test for Lyme disease. And as Mary Beth said, the routine tests miss more than half of cases with Lyme. So you really have to find a lab that's proficient in doing that testing. The testing for Lyme disease has actually become much more complicated and much more accurate lately because we're, for instance, in California, there's a lab that now tests for 12 species of Lyme bacteria, whereas before we only had a test for one. So I think we're getting much better at detecting this disease, but it's still a problem for a lot of the country.
I'm looking at a tweet here, and we're getting a number of concerns about along these lines about false positives from listeners. This is Sahali who tweets, what are the risks of false positive diagnoses and what are the side effects of the treatments? Why is the system so afraid of over-treatment?
Well, I think that over-treatment is probably preferable to missing the disease and then having somebody become chronically ill and disabled and having all the horrors of the disease. So really, again, it comes down to doing the appropriate testing for this disease. And patients have access to the Internet. They can find laboratories that do good testing. They can find physicians who order good testing. And I think that's very important to diagnose the disease.
And let me go to more calls here. But actually, first, a few questions, if I may, for you, Professor Sway. Paul wants to know, when we get a tick, should we remove it or keep it in? Does removing a tick quickly prevent Lyme disease? And how should we preserve the tick? And if we have symptoms from an unclear ailment, should we always mention to the doctor that we've been hiking?
Yes, so those factors are really important to communicate to your doctor if you start to feel symptoms and you go in. But definitely take the tick out as quickly as possible. You want to pull it out with tweezers and as close to the mouth part as possible. And don't try any of those other techniques that you might have heard about, fire or Vaseline or anything like that. Just remove the tick and its mouth part as quickly as possible because it does take the tick a while to transmit the pathogen into a human. And so if you go hiking, really prevention is about detecting ticks before they bite and removing them as quickly as possible after they've bitten you.
And since dogs are especially susceptible and people are concerned about the dog owners about ticks, what's the best way to protect against ticks with dogs or any pets for that matter?
Well, the same technique of, you know, checking your dogs after you are in the habitat that is likely to have ticks.
Let me go to another caller, and let's go to Rose, who's joining us from San Anselmo this morning. Rose, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to share a quick story, which is that I was diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2007 after visiting over 14 doctors because my health was absolutely falling apart. And I was finally diagnosed through the iGenics testing. And that was after I had gone to my primary care physician and gotten a false negative. I went to see an infectious disease doctor who told me all of my symptoms were in my head. And it's such a complicated and complex issue. But my main comment today that I wanted to ask the callers about is we were talking about scandals earlier. And I feel like one of the scandals with Lyme disease is the cost. The cost to get treatment is incredible. We ended up paying over $20,000 out of pocket because the insurance doesn't pay for a lot of what needs to be done. And you do have to go see these specialist doctors, these Lyme specialists who, in my experience, I started at one who was $350 a visit and ended up at one who was $700 a visit. And beyond that, there are all kinds of alternative treatments that are recommended. And when you're that sick, you do everything you can. And so I'll take my comment off the air.
Well, thank you for your comment. Let me go to Mary Beth Pfeiffer on this. Let's talk about expense and cost. Mary Beth Pfeiffer?
Yes, I've heard similar stories many, many times of people going on a merry-go-round of doctor's visits trying to get a diagnosis when it was believed and ultimately in many cases found that they were still suffering from Lyme disease. As we know, I said the CDC acknowledges 10 to 20% of people will not get well, at least immediately after treatment. And this really goes to the heart of the controversy of Lyme disease. Does the infection persist in the human body? Does that spirochete still live after antibiotic treatment? The CDC says no. The insurance companies say no because the Infectious Diseases Society of America says no. So basically, the insurance companies are really just following suit with the prevailing dogma that has ruled this disease not only in the United States but worldwide. So, you know, at the same time, we are indeed finding that there's research showing that we aren't able to fully eradicate the Lyme disease bug in not all people, but in some people. There have been studies in mice, in monkeys, in test tubes, in which they have thrown every antibiotic virtually under the roof at this organism and found in a sliver of cases that the organism survives. So we have a situation where people remain ill, where potentially they are still infected, but this is not recognized. And what we need to do going forward is more research. We have to find out what's going on in the bodies of these people who remain ill so they don't have to turn to a medical system that says they're not sick, that doesn't recognize or pay for their treatment.
It's a pretty hardy organism we're talking about here, isn't it, Dr. Sway?
It is. And, you know, this idea of this post-treatment Lyme disease condition is very tricky because I did some work on this as a postdoc at UCSF. And it is very difficult because about 10% of people that are treated have sort of recurring long-term symptoms. The problem is there is research going on to try to understand what is happening with these post-treatment cases. But so far, there really hasn't been we haven't been able to find the pathogen in those patients. And it may be that it's there and we just can't find it because it's hiding in the body and tissues, or it could be that it's actually an immune response or an inflammatory response after treatment.
Isn't this a spiral-shaped bacteria, kind of a corkscrew bacteria? You would think it would be easier to detect than it is.
Yeah, so it's tricky because it doesn't live in the bloodstream for very long. It just enters the bloodstream for a little bit and navigates to tissues and joints and can insist in those tissues and become, there's some evidence that it can become dormant in those phases. And so as a result, it can be really hard to detect. You have to sort of target the right tissue.
Let me go to Rafael Stricker on a comment from a listener named Enrique and get your response, Dr. Stricker. He says, ticks require hosts, and deers are the main host of ticks. A reduction in hunting means more deer. More deer in the urban interface makes for more Lyme disease. Anti-hunting regulation means more Lyme disease.
Well, deer aren't really a host for Lyme disease. They're more like the bed and breakfast for ticks. Ticks travel on deer. They mate on deer. But they don't really infect deer as much as they do small rodents. And that's the main reservoir for Lyme is things like squirrels, chipmunks, field mice, voles, shrews. That's where the Lyme bacteria really hang out. So unless you can get rid of all those rodents, you're not really going to do much by getting rid of the deer. And a good example of that actually would be the Netherlands, because there's no deer in the Netherlands, and they have the highest rate of Lyme disease and one of the highest rates in Europe. So deer really are sort of peripheral to this disease.
Boy, I think Enrique was just trying to make a case for keeping hunting.
But right.
I didn't know there were no Dutch deer. You're educating me here. I never would have imagined.
Well, let me go back to one thing about the persistent infection. So there's a recent study from Tulane that showed persistent infection of the Lyme bacteria in monkeys despite antibiotic treatment. There's a study that we just did that came out showing persistent infection in humans despite ongoing antibiotic therapy. So I think there is more and more evidence that this is a persistent infection that causes the disease, and that's why you need to do some sort of treatment for that infection.
And again, Rafael Stricker is a physician and past president of the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. And here's another caller. Jeffrey, thanks for waiting. You're
on
the
air. Good morning.
Hi.
I had a quick question. I grew up in the Sierra foothills just outside of Nevada City on 13 acres, and it seemed to me that during the wetter months there were just way more ticks around. And which leads me to kind of my next question, is there any natural or, pesticide-free way of preventing or at least abating a lot of the tick activity kind of like in and around the house so that animals don't, your pet dogs and whatnot, bring them in the house?
Can you help us here, Rafael Stricker?
Well, again, if you go to the California Department of Health website, they have techniques to avoid getting ticks in your backyard and around your house and in your garden, which is actually the most common place that people usually get infected is really in their backyard. So there are techniques for doing that, like putting sawdust down and getting rid of leaf litter and things that help protect you against ticks in your backyard.
Let me thank Jeffrey for that call and actually a related tweet here. Carl wants to know, once bitten, are you inoculated against Lyme disease? What's the rate of reinfection?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no permanent immunity against Lyme disease. You can get bitten as many times as ticks want to, and you're still at risk of getting the disease. There was a vaccine for Lyme disease that came out around the year 2000, and it was taken off the market because of intolerable side effects, and we really haven't had a vaccine since then, although there is a vaccine for dogs that does seem to protect them against Lyme disease.
Let me also mention that here in California, 42 of the 58 California counties, according to a 2014 study, have concerns and certainly problems with ticks and Lyme disease. Most of them are in Mendocino and Humboldt County and Trinity County. Those were right at the top, those three. Andrea Sway, what kind of seasonal notions do we have about ticks and Lyme disease?
Yeah, so, you know, I think some of the callers have hinted on observing more ticks in the past couple of years, and this is something that our ecological research has found as well. You know, when we were in this very long drought period, we saw lower abundances of ticks and lower prevalence of infection in those ticks as well. But since the 2017 rain year, and this winter has been a little rainy as well, you see the ticks coming out more. And we see more ticks on hosts that are able to transmit the pathogen as well. And so there are certain seasonality. They emerge in the spring, so the life stages that are able to transmit the pathogen are really active right now. This is sort of the peak.
Highest risk is in the spring.
So I would say, yeah, April, May, and June. And that's when those nymphal ticks, the ones that are transmitting Lyme disease, are most active. But studies have found that they can actually be active through the summer at just lower abundances. So it is sort of a constant risk. But I'd say that right now is the peak risk.
It has to do with the nymphs, doesn't it?
Yeah. So there are three stages in ticks. There's the larval stage, a nymphal stage, and an adult stage. And the nymphs are, when they hatch out, they are not infected with Lyme disease. But once they take their first blood meal and turn into nymphs the following year, then they can actually transmit the pathogen. So the nymphs are the primary stage that transmits Lyme disease to people.
And we're going to go to more of our callers. I want to go to a caller now who's joining us from Florida. Haley, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I am originally from New Hampshire, so I'm pretty familiar with ticks and Lyme disease. My dad was diagnosed about 2 years ago with a co-infection of Lyme and Bartonella. And I already answered my question, but I'm wondering why more doctors don't believe that chronic Lyme is an actual ongoing issue, why they don't believe in chronic Lyme, period.
Raphael Stricker?
Well, you're asking the wrong person, probably, because certainly chronic Lyme exists, and there's a lot of evidence that it does exist. Unfortunately, if you read the medical literature, there are really no studies that, again, it's kind of like transmission by ticks. There are no studies that prove that chronic Lyme exists. There's no definition for chronic Lyme disease. And that's been something that's been harped on by the infectious disease doctors that, well, you know, there's no evidence, so therefore it doesn't exist. And that's kind of the way medical thinking is. Until we have a study that proves that there's chronic Lyme disease and defines chronic Lyme disease, basically it doesn't exist.
Can you opine on this, Mary Beth Pfeiffer? How do you see it?
Well, this really goes back to the test. We don't have a good way to look at that person who is alleged to be chronically ill with Lyme disease and take a sample of their blood or what have you and say that the spirochete is living in that person. That's the problem. At the heart of this issue is a very poor diagnostic test. Lyme doctors use other kinds of tests, ones that are not that are perfectly legal but not sanctioned as the way that we are supposed to diagnose Lyme disease, to find evidence of the organism in the bodies of these people. But if we had a better test, we would solve this whole controversy. We'd be able to say, yes, you are chronically infected, or no, you're not. But, you know, in the landscape of Lyme disease, because this has become so controversial, because the CDC side, the mainstream side, is so hardened in its position that this does not exist, there's not much research going on to answer the problem of how do we deal with the ongoing disabilities of many people who have been bitten by ticks. That's where we need to go. More research, answer these questions.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer's book is Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. Let me bring another caller aboard here, and that's Ali. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Oh, thank you for taking my call. And my idea, which I used before, the best way to test whether you have the Lyme disease or not is to test the tick. When you are bitten, that's when the real worry starts. If you can remove the tick intact, and there are labs around the Bay Area. For example, there's one in San Rafael that can test it for you. They come back in a week or so, and then you pay like around, I don't know, $20 or something like that, and then you know whether the tick has the disease or not.
All these points well taken, Andrew Sway. If you get the tick, you can learn a lot.
It's much easier to detect the pathogen in the tick than it is in a human body, because with the tick, we do this routinely in our lab. We just take the whole tick and crush it up, and then we can find the bacteria's DNA. I'd like to say one thing about this issue of co-infections that has been brought up a few times, though, if I may. So, you know, I think it's important to clarify that there are certainly lots of different pathogens that these ticks can transmit, but they don't. One tick species doesn't transmit all of these pathogens. They're transmitted differentially by different tick species. And so you have the tick that transmits Lyme disease. It does not transmit Babesia, for instance, in California. It does on the East Coast, but not here. There are other pathogens like Rocky Mountain spotted fever that are also not transmitted by the Western black-legged tick that transmits Lyme disease here in California. So it's important to really understand the associations of the pathogens with the vectors and to not lump all ticks into one group. There are lots of different species.
Andrea Sway, I know we have to say goodbye to you, but I want to thank you and grateful to have you here. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Andrea Sway again is Assistant Professor of Biology at San Francisco State University. And I'll thank the caller, Ali, and look at some of the comments that are coming in. Ty writes, our 10-year-old son was released from the hospital just yesterday after being diagnosed with Lyme disease. He doesn't remember getting bitten by a tick and never had the bullseye rash, but recently developed pretty severe eye inflammation. We're curious to know if any of your experts have seen cases like this where the only symptom is eye inflammation. Raphael Stricker?
Well, Lyme disease can cause lots of different symptoms, and eye inflammation, actually optic nerve inflammation, is usually the symptom that's seen with blurred vision. That's a very typical kind of Lyme symptom. Eye inflammation could be a lot of different things, but certainly it could be associated with Lyme disease.
And Jones wants to know, if diagnosed with Lyme disease, is it safe to donate blood?
Well, the Blood Bank Association does not exclude patients with Lyme disease from donating blood. The reason is that the Lyme bacteria doesn't seem to survive very well under blood banking conditions. So the theory is that, you know, if you donate blood, then whatever's in it that's related to Lyme will be killed, and then it's okay. We don't have any evidence that that's not true, so I guess for now you can donate blood if you have Lyme disease. Now, if you have Babesia, that's a different story because it's been shown that Babesia can definitely be transmitted through blood transfusion, and if you have a history of Babesia, you shouldn't donate blood. Let me say one thing about what Andrea said, and that is that it's never been proven that Babesia is transmitted by the same ticks as the Lyme bacteria. And so, again, if you're a purist, then you can say it's not transmitted. But the truth is that we see lots and lots of patients who are co-infected with those two infections. So certainly, from a clinical perspective, it looks like Babesia is getting transmitted by the same tick.
And let me go back, if I may, to you, Mary Beth Pfeiffer. Marissa, one of our listeners, wants to know how you can actually know a lab does good testing.
That's a good question. There are alternative labs to the ones that basically do the, you know, frontline CDC-sanctioned two-tier test. Igenix in the Bay Area has a very good reputation. It uses a different technology. It uses a couple of different strains of the organism to perhaps be better able to capture signs that this bug is in your system. But, you know, patients don't really have a lot of guidance on where they can go. If their test is negative in the traditional sense, but they and their doctor think that they may, in fact, still have Lyme disease. This is the problem of a disease that has more or less been abandoned by mainstream medicine. Doctors who treat it, like Dr. Stricker and others here on the East Coast, are left to sort of figure it out for themselves with very little guidance from mainstream medicine, figure out how to diagnose it, what tests to use, what treatments to use. You know, antibiotics are not the only thing that it should be used and is used against this bug. But again, we need to support efforts to figure out how to go about this, not only from diagnosing, but from the treating perspective.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer with us from Woodstock, New York. Her book is Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change. And let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Mike. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Mike. I'm a veteran who had two tick bites while on active service, one in Virginia, one in Southern California. More recently, I've been diagnosed with Lyme, and I had a test called the Western blot, a positive test for the Western blot. My question is really, does anyone know if the Veterans Administration recognizes Lyme disease and what tests they require? Is the Western blot a recognized test?
Dr. Stricker.
So the VA does recognize Lyme disease. It follows CDC guidelines for diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease, which means that you shouldn't just have a Western blot. You should first have a screening test for the disease, which misses more than half of the disease cases. So chances are if you'd had that, you wouldn't have gotten to the Western blot because your screening test would have been negative. And then even if they recognize a positive Western blot, your treatment is 2 to 3 weeks of antibiotics, and then you're cured. And even if you have persistent symptoms, that's it. So unfortunately, this is the kind of disconnect that we have between government agencies who have a certain view of the disease and the real world, where the disease is much worse than that.
Well, apropos of that disease being much worse than perhaps is anticipated, we've got seconds left here. I'd like to know, Dr. Stricker, especially in light of the CDC report, are we in a public health crisis now with Lyme disease?
We definitely are. This is a huge epidemic. It's a hidden epidemic, and basically a lot of the government agencies are ignoring it. What we really need for this disease, and this is my personal bias, is that we need better treatment for the disease. We're using, you know, ancient antibiotics that don't work very well. If you look at things like HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C virus, we have designer drugs that work beautifully for that, that cost a lot of money to develop, and we need the same thing for Lyme disease.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to express thanks to you, Dr. Raphael Stricker, who joined us by phone this morning, past president of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Stricker.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
And thank you, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, author of Lyme, the First Epidemic of Climate Change, and investigative journalist for the last three decades. Good to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Michael. Let's fight ticks.
All right. And I also thank Professor Andrea Sway, who was also with us. And as far as thanks are concerned, we thank our producers, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, Anna Sterling, and Angela Corral. Senior editors Dan Zoll, and our engineers are Katie McMurrin and Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Lisa Botman and Ali Wolner. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud, whose work is on view at the museum through May 13, 2018.
Political Breakdown unpacks politics with a California perspective.
We'll pull back the curtain on the week's political twists and turns with political insiders.
Find Political Breakdown wherever you get your podcasts.